Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Bill Correll. Bill Correll is a seasoned entrepreneur and real estate investor known for his leadership and networking skills. With a career spanning various manufacturing management roles, he founded PDS Inc. and has a history of owning and managing multiple businesses. His real estate ventures since 1993 include over 20 properties, complemented by his role in homeowners associations. As a committed volunteer, Bill has served as chairman and leader on over 15 boards, not-for-profits, and commissions focusing on human potential. His networking acumen connects him with professionals across numerous sectors, enhancing his influence and outreach. Bill's advocacy work includes leading community groups like the Willimantic Downtown Revitalization Task Force and contributing to statewide initiatives in Connecticut. A certified life and business coach, he assists professionals and organizations in achieving their goals, emphasizing minor yet impactful changes through his 5% effect philosophy. Innovative in integrating technology into his businesses, Bill has supported not-for-profits in improving operations and funding stability. Bill is a published collaborating author, including Faces of Grief. His podcast, Lighting the Candle, A World That Works, recently celebrated its 194th episode, showcasing his dedication to inspirational living. Bill is passionate about empowering individuals, especially children, to live fulfilling lives. He cherishes time with his grandsons, wife Janet, extended family, and networking associates. And like me, Bill is a cat lover, so he passed one of the requirements to become a guest contributor on the podcast. So with that, Bill, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I've been excited about our conversation for some time now.
Dave, thank you so much. I share your excitement and the passion for cats. It is great to be their subjects, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, it's great. You know, they get a chance to pick whoever the human they align with. And it's just, I always said, it's my cat's world and I'm just living in it.
I have to agree with you. Since we first got together back in 1974, my wife have had approximately, we can't really remember all the cats, but it's around 34 or 35 cats over that number of years. And we're without them right now because the last two guys that passed broke our hearts so badly, we just decided we were going to take a break for a minute.
Yeah, I think that's how my wife Sherry and I felt after our last cat, Zoe, transitioned. She was just such a joy in our lives. So when she transitioned in 2022, we just have, you know, it really just really broke our hearts so much that we just haven't gone back into cat ownership. But I've learned that animals more often than not pick us as opposed to us picking them. So once the cat comes along that kind of picks me and we can kind of sense our energy, that cat's probably coming home with me.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The first cat that didn't just show up at our door back in 1974, that cat was mauled by a dog and transitioned, as you say. But we were invited to come over and see the litter of kittens that it left behind. And there was this little runt, kind of a beige tiger, and he was really struggling to get in there and get his food. So we picked him, and we took him home, and he grew to be a 23-pound cat.
That's a big cat.
It was a big cat.
I would have hated to see the food bill on that one. But hey, as long as they're healthy, happy, and strong, that's all that matters. And we're going to be talking about cats. Believe me, I have a question later in the podcast related to cats. So we're going to do this kind of like a nice prelude into what we're going to be talking about later, but I have several questions for you. And the questions that I came up with, I think, attest to your varied skills and your varied roles and categories. But the first category I want to explore with you is grief. So please tell our listeners about the deaths that have most impacted your worldview and perspective.
So as I think back over my lifetime, going back to my earliest notion of loss, it started actually with my grandfather on my mother's side, who passed when she was 9 years old. That he was missing was strange to me. Other people had two grandfathers. I only had one. Time went on. I lost my second grandfather when I was in eighth grade. But these were just, you know, experiences to go through. We had other people that were a lot older, you know, to kind of shepherd us through this and give me a shot. Life goes on. And, you know, when you get to be our age, mine in particular, I'll be 71 next month, hundreds of people, you know, from all walks of life. And some, the effect of their passing or their transitioning, as you say, is not felt at the time that they go. There's not time to even notice. In some cases, it's just coming so quickly. COVID changed all that. There was just too much time and too many people in my family, my networking groups, friends, you know, just lifetime people that I knew, liked, and loved that were going every single month. And not just one, but I had a couple of favorite aunts that passed during that period of time. I lost my best friend of 40 some years and my dad, who was a best friend in his own right. It just was, you know, I would kind of compare it to when I first started distance running in high school. I couldn't do 3 miles. I would die somewhere around 2. And I felt like I was running the last mile with no energy and no stamina. So all of those were equally on the pile, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of loss. And I tell my students in my death, dying, and bereavement class, there's a privilege in getting older, but there's also a downside, is that the older you get, the more funerals you go to and the more loss you experience. But on the flip side of the coin, I'm glad that I've had the privilege to grow older, because there's many individuals who haven't, and particularly many young adults, including my daughter, Janine, who did not have the privilege of growing older. So as I approach 70, I am grateful for the fact that I have been given an opportunity to grow older and to do a lot of the things that I love doing. And I just step back and think about the people who haven't gotten as far as me age-wise.
Yeah, it's a blessing to have loved so many people so deeply and to be alive and to feel it in such a robust and distinguishable way, you know, that whole opportunity to grow as a human being, as somebody who's in their seventh decade, it wasn't predictive. I thought I'd probably have most things in life handled by the time I was 50. Well, I've learned a lot more since I turned 50 than I did for the 50 years before.
Well, you know, just that we think we got things handled. And I've said this on other podcasts, the universe says, hold my beer.
Yep.
And you thought you had things handled. You thought you had a plan. Well, here's the plan. And it's our job to see where we align with it. While maintaining, you know, our free will as well, too. Because any path that opens up to us, well, you know, after grief or any perspective, we have the option to embrace that perspective. We have the option not to embrace it.
Yeah, and I would also say you kind of have to be an awake human being to have that choice.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part of the last 4 or 5 years, up until about a month after my dad passed, which is coming up on his second anniversary, I didn't feel like I was in a position of choice. I really felt like I was more or less like the flotsam and jetsam in the sea being crashed against the shore over and over and over again, with really no time to catch my breath, while still trying to be a productive human being, making a living and working with all my clients and friends.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance. And to have that type of structure in place where at least you have some purpose that can help us eventually find our purpose after grief and loss. For some people, it does take a while for them to really re-engage and find their purpose again in life. But You know, time is relative when it comes to the journey of grief and loss. It's about progress. It's not how quick you get there. As long as you just keep moving towards re-engagement in life, time is basically relative.
Completely agree with you. Although I can speak personally, I can't really talk too well from other people's perspectives. I have to tell you, hearing verbally from them what they've gone through is nothing like experiencing the actual trauma that they did go through. But from my perspective, I can tell you that I didn't feel like checking in for long periods at a time. And thank God my phone of friends were already out there. People came looking for me, and that's a blessing.
Yeah, I think that kind of support, those type of individuals that are vested in our well-being, that will check on us, even if they just grace us with their presence and say nothing, that can help us get through some really difficult moments.
Dave, I got to tell you, there's probably a dozen, 15 different people. I stopped saying the traditional business greetings a long time ago. And so I've got hundreds of different people that when we meet, we hug. And when we say goodbye, we say, I love you, you know?
Yep.
And the fact of the matter is that it's not a love that needs any explanation whatsoever. But I'll tell you this, to have somebody on your worst day just call in out of the blue and say, you know what, Bill, I love you, man.
That one gesture in and of itself can make the worst day that you've ever had, grief or non-grief related, a good day.
Amen, brother.
So tell us about Faces of Grief. I know this was a collaborative effort with, I think, about 30 other authors, and you wrote a chapter for the book. Tell us about the chapter that you wrote and what your feelings and thoughts were as you were putting this chapter together.
How long do we have here?
We got as long as you want, man. Time's relative. I told you.
Yeah, I love that about you. You and I come from the same place. The quality of communication makes time just meaningless.
That's right.
First of all, I had come out of the cave a little bit, and I got introduced to this really wonderful young lady, Kate. And I know you know Kate. She's completely amazing. And it turned out that she was up to her eyeballs in doing grief, you know, death cafes, okay, which sounded to me pretty odd the first time I heard that. But I spent some time around her and I started thinking in terms of what all's going on here. So that was November, a little over a year ago. And about a month later, she said, Bill, I got somebody you got to talk to. Her name is Samantha and she's out in Colorado and she's doing this book and I think you'd be fantastic for it. So I did it. And, you know, I've not written anything as intentional or even as intense. I've been published in a lot of articles and magazines and, you know, local, you know, newspaper, that sort of thing. So I thought, well, yeah, this is a reach for me and I can always use another challenge at this age. No idea what to write, where to begin, so many different people to talk about. And the goal was to write something that was under, I think, originally 2,000 words. And that got expanded, thankfully. So I just decided to kind of focus in on my best friend of 43 years, Bob, and my dad. Completely different relationships with the two of them. And so I went through about maybe two or three writes and edits. And by the time April came, which from February to April was the time period that I had my chapter written, we had gone online in this type of a Zoom meeting maybe a dozen different times, with everybody sharing their grief story. Quite frankly, I had to get off sometimes because I just couldn't have my nose up against the glass for that long, hearing other people's trauma, growth exercise for me. And so I was one of the first ones probably to get my chapter blessed. I was done, you know, at that time period. And then I got involved with other people. And then they kept calling and saying, hey, we need you to go show up for this or go show up for that. So I was on a couple of other different shows, Open to Hope down in New York City with Heidi. Heidi's fantastic. You know, Jason, who I think you also are pretty good friends with in New Jersey. And long story short, the whole experience was, you know, kind of a series of, I have no idea how to do this. I'm just going to trust the people that are involved. They're all great people. And some of them, I found that I was pretty much one of the only people that was not making or trying to make a living in the grief space. I was just somebody who had some loss that I wanted to tell other people about if it helped them, you know? So the transformation for me, I didn't cry when I was writing my story, although other people reported that they had a hard time, they had to stop while they were writing. And I loved hearing their stories about what their experience was thinking back more than hearing about their loss. So I really felt like I was sharing in their journey as well, as opposed to helping them, you know, kind of cement their, I used to call it, you know, being a monument, you know, to your trauma. These were people that were actively really trying to get something out of their heart and get it into words. And language is just not sufficient, you know, to express what goes on deep inside your soul and is in your memories and all that. So that's a long story to tell you this, that it was transformational for me. And I think, you know, the final output, the process was a lot like grief, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of miscommunications, a lot of people not knowing, you know, when you're trying to do anything with 30 different people to accomplish something. Who was it? Benjamin Franklin once said, when they were writing the Declaration of Independence, he said, it's very difficult to get 13 clocks to chime at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that came to mind for me very several times. But I think I brought something to the party in terms of telling people, just hang out. Don't make this mean anything. Just stick in it. Wait, things will work themselves out. So the book writing process, telling my story, hearing other people's story, I would look forward to doing that again, differently. It'll be whatever it's going to be, but that was fantastic for me, my friend.
It sounds like it was a very cathartic and a very healing process, I think, for a lot of people. The thing that struck me is when you have 30 people on a call, each sharing their story, sharing their perspectives, you have a built-in support group right there. The implied norm or the stated norm is that we are here to bear witness to each other's pain, to each other's progress, and we're here to hold space for that. And together we can help carry each other's pain so that we can collectively turn that pain into purpose, which is what the Faces of Grief book obviously is about individuals turning their pain into purpose and sharing what had worked for them.
That is very well said. It was never about just being cathartic. It was all about, hey, we've been here. Maybe we can leave a bread trail to even one or two other people. If somebody gets benefit out of this, it'll be worth the energy we put into it.
Speaking of tools, what tools would you like readers to take away from your journey and from the journeys of the other 29 authors in that book?
Well, that's interesting. I think the first tool, and it's in the education domain, it has to do with always asking better questions. When you think you know something is when you're pretty much going to be locked out of the next discovery. Having an answer in life is the booby prize. Having a better question in life is what we're striving for, in my opinion. And that has to do with grief, too. Although grief is a little bit like getting punched in the nose by Mike Tyson and then trying to figure out what to do next. My suggestion is do not hit back. You know, take a moment, try to figure out what just happened, and then find out what's in it for you. Find out where the gold is going to be in terms of you're still here. You know, I'm still here. And there's something that the world is calling me to do. And I'm more or less answering your whole question altogether. And I found that people actually did, they had great growth in terms of the type of outreaches that they were doing. They had newfound energy in terms of doubling their efforts. There's a great, great man in Michigan named Dan, who has these amazing stories and writes them the best poems I've ever heard. The whole nature of being genuine and authentic, you and I both know that these are not things that you talk about. These are not words that you say, I'm going to be authentic now, or no, it's like pregnancy. You either is or you isn't, you know, and the energy that you put into focusing on yourself and your own performance when we got to the point over and over and over again where all people were trying to do was to make their chapter better, make the book better, and make future lives better in terms of, you know, what does this whole grief process and bereavement look like? You know, if the government takes it on, if your community takes it on, if churches are not in the business of just consoling people, what if they're in the business of making people greater as a result of the door they just went through?
Yeah, and I mean, any challenge that we choose to transcend should make us greater than we were before. It should give us a different perspective that's going to help us re-engage in a world that's different.
It's almost a Nietzscheism, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were some things that he was spot on about. The human condition is never about standing still.
No. It's always about moving forward in growth.
Exactly. The greater the challenge, the greater the opportunity, and the greater the question to come out of the experience.
I think some of the best interactions I've had with individuals, some of the best research studies that I have read have generated more questions than answers.
I agree with you. That's really mm-hmm. what it's supposed to do. If it's to produce an answer, it's probably funded by somebody who's got an axe to grind or a stake in the deal.
And, you know, authenticity isn't easy for people to achieve because being authentic means that you have to get in touch with everything about yourself. That's the yin and the yang. It's just not about the joyful moments. It's about getting in touch with everything and saying, you know, this sadness made me who I am. Angry moments made me who I am. Being disillusioned made me who I am. Being confused made me who I am. It's not all about happiness, but these are the parts of me that I can mirror for you that help me be authentic. And in grief, it's embracing or making space for just not the joyful moments, but it's also learning from those moments that are not so joyful.
I love that. And I want to say that that speaks volumes for the intellectual side of it.
Yep.
That, you know, the learning that is knowledge-based. Well, there's the emotional side, which has absolutely nothing to do with knowledge. You know, the emotional side, which is that visceral thing that happens when you have an experience and then you're altered in, you know, forever. The best thing I can say is that, you know, the three things that come to mind for me is number one, balance on a bicycle. Number two is rhythmic breathing in swimming. And number three is having a child. Those three things change you at such a profound level, you can't remember what it was like before it occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of, you know, to get back to what you were saying about embracing all of those things, yes, there's that. But then there's also the opportunity to completely denounce all of them at the same time and say, authenticity comes from not using any one of those things as tools, but just in spite of all of that and in spite of what I know, I'm just going to be here who I am right now in this minute. And that's going to be sufficient because my attention is going to be on you and the world and not on me.
That's right. Being present in an authentic sense means, you know, this is who I am. This is my talk. My words match my behavior.
Yep.
This is who I am. You know,
yep.
Love me or leave me.
Yeah, I like that. The tongue in your mouth and the tongue in your shoe both go in the same direction.
Yep. That is so true. I know that you have been a chairman and committee leader on over 15 boards that have been focused on maximizing human potential. What do you see as the keys to individuals maximizing their own human potential? I say this because I think many times a lot of society may look at our limitations as opposed to our potential.
All right. So my answer to that right this minute is to never look at a human being as to who they are right now. Try to see that human being as who they are, fully actualized, authentically being what you see that works about them now, absolutely out to the nth degree in the future, and interact with them as if they're already that person. As a leader, from a community standpoint and in business, my goal always was to steward people through very transformational opportunities that looked to them like really bad ideas at the beginning. And I would always engage them as to what their commitment is. Where do you want to be when you're done? I mean, why are you doing this? What's your life for? I would engage with people like that especially when we were doing community work, and then step back. Step back and be amazed. And, you know, use the powers of, you know, positive reinforcement, of questions as opposed to statements, to allow people to grow like weeds before my eyes. And if there's anything that I ever did that worked, it was because I allowed them to be inspiring to the other people in the group, one person at a time. And I always believed we don't have a team with a star on it. We don't have a team with two stars on it, and the rest are supporting cast. One star, all stars. We take turns doing it, and everybody gets to bring what is the best thing that they have to contribute to humanity. Otherwise, why are we here? You know, we're just going through the motions, having meetings. So it was always more important to me to be outcome-based in terms of leading groups, and less to do with the performance on a particular day. And when I finally decided to operate that way in my mid-30s, we did some good things. Let's just put it that way. And some people grew way beyond what they ever expected at the beginning.
Well, you know, if you treat people as if you expect great things from them, that you tell them, take your past history and throw it out the window once you've come into this environment, I would treat you as if you're capable of doing great things. I would plant those seeds. And what happens is, I think outcomes are driven by our belief in the human's potential to reach their greatest moments or greatest heights, their greatest capabilities. If we treat them as capable, they are going to respond, and the outcomes are going to take care of themselves.
Yeah, there's definitely that. And I actually looked at it from this perspective, that people do what's a natural action. And this is where I developed my 5% philosophy from. What they will not do, what is not a natural action. So you can't hire somebody based on their resume and then put them into a social situation, business situation where their resume is going to do the talking. It doesn't mean anything. So I've always found that people respond best and go the furthest when it's their idea.
Yep.
So my goal always and everywhere, you know, in terms of engaging groups of people, has always been, well, let's just see if we're talking about great things, if anything calls to you. Mm-hmm. And let's hear what your contribution is. You know, it's sort of a networking Marco Polo, you know, where I say Marco and they say Polo back. And the next thing that you know, we take a guy who came to work for me as a tech, doing computer repairs and that sort of thing, who could not say five words in a row, you know, at our meetings with seven fellow employees at Progressive Data Systems. 2 years later, he was leading training courses for 150 clinicians at one of our clients when they were doing a across-the-board enterprise-wide software update. He actually created all of the curriculum for the trainings. He created all the screens. He did everything with regard to, he would never have believed when he couldn't say words in a meeting, just, hi, Chris, how are you doing? And he would get all tongue-tied, and we would all laugh a little bit and say, that's good. That's two more words than he got out last time, you know? But you should have seen him in front of people that were 50 and 60 years old, holding them in the palm of his hand while he led them through the trainings.
Well, that's about creating an environment where you allow people to succeed to the extent that they wish to succeed, recognize their potential, but also put them in positions where they can succeed. You know, like I tell my students, I'm a licensed master social worker, so you're not going to see me do brain surgery because it wouldn't be pretty. And it's beyond my capability. And I had a very wise mentor. He was an ex-Navy SEAL commander and a social worker. And he knew how to build teams. And I watched what he did. He knew everybody's strengths. He knew everybody's limitations. So he put people in positions of strength. And we all were able to just compensate for our limitations because he maximized our strength potential. But the only way we were able to compensate for our limitations is he insisted that we work with each other, that we cover each other, that we work together as a team, not individuals within a team.
Right, right. I love that. And I would say that I've got other words to use in terms of strengths. They would be habits. They would be what I lovingly refer to, their natural actions.
Yep.
Anything that you have mastered that's now become part of who you are is something that you can explain to someone else in their own language to be able to hear you and understand. While you're still trying to learn how to do something, you use the words that you were taught, even though they don't mean anything to you. And when you engage a group of a dozen or 15 different people and you make the game about learning all you possibly can from the other people who possess skills and possess habits that you don't yet have, but you admire and you see the value of those to get you where you want to go on your track, it changes the game entirely. There's no politics. There's some good-natured ribbing and that sort of thing. And that's because it's peer-to-peer. It's never from a high level to low level.
Yep. And that's the way it should be. It should be based on just our qualities as a human being and our just ability to be human.
Yeah. And having, you know, things that you're working on that are bigger than yourself. I think that's the thing that gets most people out of bed in the morning is if the challenge that's in front of them is something they know they cannot do themselves, they're not ever going to get bored with it. They're sure as hell not bored with it right now.
No. And being connected to something greater than themselves is one requirement of spiritual growth. We can foster or we can create an environment for spiritual growth in any profit or not-for-profit agency if we have that as one of our mission statements, one of our values, or just one of our operative norms.
Yeah, and I think I'll soapbox for just a moment. You know, in my experience, unfortunately, there have been formulas that have been done over and over and over again, and people have made millions of dollars in terms of the health self-help industry. There are these, MLM and all that. The mechanical pieces are all there, but they're poorly executed. And they're not done with an intention of creating a different lifestyle for the person who they're training. It has more to do about making them subjects, more about making them easier to give requests to, or now spend your time doing this, or now spend your money doing this so that you're earning your way by spending your money, whatever. So the time is the most important element that any of us have. If you've ever had money, you absolutely know that there are things that when I was in my 20s, that by the time I was 40 years old, I had all that and a lot more, but that wasn't what I valued at that point. We shifted our game and we went from, you know, after the dog dies and after the kids get out of school and after this and after that. Well, we started shifting our attention to when we have grandchildren, you know? Mm-hmm. There was always a bigger purpose in life for us to be planning for, to give some meaning to us in those moments, in those day-to-day moments where it really didn't seem like we were accomplishing anything, or we were definitely doing things that didn't seem like they were headed in the right direction.
Yeah. And I think when we can make each other aware of the other categories we have in our lives besides work, besides school, I think it helps us, I think, become more grateful and also helps us, you know, if we add those categories, it just, I think, makes us better all around. It just makes us more well-rounded human beings. And, you know, what we get out of this life is what mark do we leave in this world as a human being?
Yeah. And to kind of jump off from there back to authenticity and genuine behavior, what I noticed in, you know, from the time I became an adult, it was really important to me to have different personas, the persona at church, the persona at work, who I am with my family at home, who I am out with the guys, you know, having a pitcher of beer, all the fellow supervisors and that sort of thing. And so by the time I got to be 35 years old, I really felt fractured. I felt like, you know, which one of these me's is really the you know, I couldn't tell which one was who I was anymore, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I came to a realization that this is just too hard to work. You know, I mean, I'm out talking to groups of people, 100, 200 people talking about neighborhood revitalization zone legislation and big cities in our state and giving them the opportunity to make a choice to stand up for their community where they had blighted neighborhoods and they really wanted to do something about it, but they didn't know how.
Yeah.
And so what I decided to do and how I started being on a dozen different boards, I just decided I don't have to know anything anymore. I just have to show up and be competent.
Mm-hmm.
And that showing up and being competent really took so much weight off of my shoulders. It allowed me to just show up and genuinely listen to what people had to say, be able to give it back to them until I actually understood what they were saying. We went from a situation where it took 2 years to get the legislation and ordinances passed in a local community to I showed people how to do it in 6 months. And this means with the blessing of the, you know, the legislature of the state of Connecticut, the town councils in each one of these cities. And I had some really, really intelligent help. And I got to be really great friends with the lieutenant governor, Jody Rell, at that time, who ultimately became governor of the state. And it's just one of those neat things that happens as a result of trying to work on a project that both of you agree is worth doing.
Absolutely. And I like the fact that you came in there not knowing everything, because we don't know everything, but together we can come pretty close to knowing more than each one of us individually, which is the mantra of this podcast. It relates to that, which is we're all students and teachers, so let's learn from each other. I go into any situation not trying to impart knowledge, but to trying to learn, and as well as share what's worked for me. But what's worked for me may not necessarily work for somebody else, so I need to listen to other individuals' perspectives and kind of expand on my perspective if it fits.
Yeah, you and I are not too many moons apart in terms of age. And I think in our early years, it looked to us like the authoritarian approach where where people had to know things in order to lead a group of people, or they would be, you know, discounted or, you know, undercut by other people who, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. So we wanted to try to be that person. And at some point, it took me longer because I'm not as smart as some people. But when I finally figured it out, life became easy. I mean, it really, you know, it was to the point where we would talk about something at a meeting, show up at the next meeting, and I didn't send out reminders to anybody, but they all came back in. This is what we talked about last time. I promised to do this. You know, we used the old who, do, what, by when kind of a method, and they were doing it on their own. And so I would call one of them and I would say, can you run this meeting the next time? I won't be there. But then I would show up and I would sit in the back of the room.
Yeah, that's pretty cool because it's empowering for that individual to be able to say that, you know, Bill trusts me enough where he's going to let me lead a meeting. He's going to sit back and just stay quiet and listen. And that sends a message to employees that, you know, as leaders, we need to be good listeners as well as being able to share whatever knowledge or wisdom we've accumulated as well, too. It works both ways. And it builds relationships that are sustaining.
To this day, actually, in many cases. The neat part of that, too, was, you know, the biggest win for me was in a meeting when somebody took over, whether I stayed present or I was not there, was the notion of walking out to the parking lot having thought, that SOB did a better job than me. Isn't that great?
Yeah, because good leaders realize that they want people on their team that are better than them or have the potential to be better than them. Not as good as. Not worse than, but better than.
There's an old saying that I really love, which is if you go to meetings and you're consistently the smartest person in the room, you're going to the wrong meetings.
Absolutely. I want to shift focus for a second. We talked about our love of cats earlier in the podcast. So as a cat lover, what can cats teach us about life? What can cats teach us about humanity that perhaps humans can't?
Everything. And I mean, cats are like every other family person and member of your network in that you can learn something from every last one of them. I've been really blessed to have some cats that, you know, you talked about earlier that they pick you out and you're the one. and they've been male and female over the years, but that bond and that relationship have been really special. A couple of things that I think of immediately was it would be learning how to be unconditionally loving, of having no memory for anything that went bad and having a long memory for anything that went good. My kitty cats would, I'll talk about two, TJ. And I don't know if you're a cat person, there's no way you can be around a cat for 18 or 19 years without giving it a lot of loving nicknames. Well, TJ became Sneedleberry and a dozen other things. But the point is, he was a Maine Coon cat and he was a herder. We have a big house here. I'm sitting in my living room right now. There's a foyer over here that opens into a dining room, and that dining room opens into the kitchen. If I'm in the living room and my wife is in the kitchen sitting at the island doing whatever she's doing, TJ was over in the dining room so he could look through the doors and see me and see her at the same time so that he was maintaining his control over the situation. To some people, it would look like he was controlling it. And other to other people, he would just be kind of like a border collie, where all he's doing is maintaining, you know, the outer limits of where the pride is going. And that community feeling of the pride. At one point, we had, are you ready, Dave?
Yep.
18 cats.
Wow.
Eight were indoors, and the rest of them were outdoor cats. So we live one block from Eastern Connecticut State University over here. And at the end of every semester, stray cats show up on the street because people who are graduating from college or dropping out or whatever, who had kitty cats, they don't take them with them in a lot of cases. So we ended up opening up a soup kitchen out on the back porch. We had a 3-gallon container for dry food. And then we had a watering dish that actually was heated. We plugged it into an outlet out there.
Mm-hmm.
So at any particular time, there would be cats draped all over the furniture in this living room. And we all just got along. I mean, the pride got along. It was never any discord. So the other thing that I want to say is that I learned how to cat talk and cat whisper from a guy named Puffy. And one of our cats had a litter. We had two that had litters, but the second one, who was when my kids were, you know, in grammar school, Nermal, she had a litter, and she had a difficult time with one kitty cat that was Breach. I called my vet and said, "What do you do?" And Todd said, "Got to get that baby out of there." I said, "Well, I'm tugging on him, but it doesn't want to come. I might break its back or neck." And he said, "You got to do that, or you're going to lose them all." So I did. And of course, we named that baby Norman, you know, from City Slickers, you know, with the Breech calf delivery. So that became Norman. And Nermal, you know, that bond was so strong. She would just show up and she'd be here looking. Her face would be like 3 inches away from me, and I'm watching TV and she's just sitting there making biscuits and purring. So the listening to her, that she was in labor and she was struggling over in the corner of the room. And then the next time that something like that happened was when one of her offspring, Puffy, he grew to be a 25-pound, almost calico. I would swear he was a male calico, but everybody said doesn't make any difference anyway, so give it up, Bill. I was on a business trip, and I came home from that business trip, and they had decided to give Puffy away, and they did, to another home in the neighborhood. Well, 2 years went by, and word got back to us that they were thinking about putting Puffy down because they had a child with Down syndrome that was getting scratched by Puffy. Well, Puffy came back, and of course, Puffy was miserable. You know, he would hiss at me and all the rest of that sort of stuff. And I said, "This isn't the cat that we used to have here." And I went over and I looked at his mouth, and his gums were inflamed. They literally were red. We got him over to the vet. They cleaned up his teeth. 2 weeks later, he was back to the same old docile puppy, sitting up on a stool in the kitchen begging for treats. So learning how to listen a little bit better and become more interested in what's going on behind the behavior as opposed to just the behavior. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, the cats that I've had have taught me about resilience. They have allowed me to see that the caretaking role goes beyond being a physical caretaker, that there's so many different aspects to that. Because for me, with one of my cats, Bootsy, who was my daughter Janine's favorite cat, he allowed me to take care of him in a lot of different ways. And I had always lamented that I was not a better physical caregiver to my daughter than anybody else in my family. But I wasn't meant to be a physical caregiver. I was meant to provide emotional caregiving. And right. Bootsy reminded me of that, especially every time he sat in my lap and, you know, he just let me pet him and just love him up. So I think our cats can also remind us that the limitations we thought we had were not actually limitations at all.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I can tell you this, the last two guys that we had, the old gentleman, one passed when he was 20 and the other one passed when he was 19. And Boo, so many stories. I will write a book just about Boo, but also one about TJ. At the end of days, we went through 4 or 5 months of injecting with Ringer's fluid because they were having problems with kidneys and that sort of thing, which was a labor of love, even though it was a little bit like sticking your hand in a jar of bees. He did not take to it really well, but how he went out, he really started to get bad, you know, right by the end. And he was struggling in the other room and I heard him. And I went in and I got him and I cleaned him up because he had fallen down in the box and had, you know, had some water before that. And so he was all messed up. So I brought him back out here in the living room. I had him on my lap and he was struggling and he was looking up at me. And I finally just said to him, I said, look, you've been a champion. You've been a fighter. You know, you don't have to go through this anymore. You know, yeah. It's okay with me if you go. He just kind of looked up at me. He said, had his last breath, and that's when he transitioned.
And you were the person he wanted to transition him to a new existence. You were the person he chose to do that.
He really did. I mean, there were so many other ways that we could go back and talk about how he chose us for the previous 19 years, but they were all good boys.
Yeah, so are the four that I've had, and the ones that came before them were all just great animals, just great personalities, and they taught me a lot about life, singularly and collectively.
Well, you know, when you have a population of 30-something, there's going to be a bell curve there, and you're going to have the brilliant ones out here at this end, and then you have the other ones over here. You're not quite sure what happened to them, but they're not quite with the program, if you will. So we did have some great stories about a couple of our kitty cats that were beautiful looking. I mean, absolutely gorgeous, but didn't have, you know, an ounce of brains. It was a box of rocks, you know?
Yeah, but they all got something to teach us regardless of their capabilities. Everything is in service to us.
Agreed.
Let's go to your podcast, the Lighting the Candle podcast. Tell us about the inspiration for the podcast and how it just aligns with your overall life philosophy.
Easy to talk about how it aligns with my overall philosophy. I love people. And there is nothing in life that gives me a greater high than seeing somebody win. And I mean, literally being unrecognizable to themselves and afterwards reporting, I don't know who that was while I was doing that or whatever it is that they say. So here we are, 2020. We're like 4 months into COVID of the shutdown in the summertime. And I'm watching the, you know, from Minneapolis West, big cities on fire, something going on, which I don't understand at all. And it just seemed like no matter where I looked, all the news was talking about was the angst between people and what was going on. And who was justified to do this and whatever. But I thought to myself, people can't exist on a diet of that kind of news and information all the time. Where do we go to get something that's just plain positive?
Mm-hmm.
So the conversation of empowerment, I wasn't finding easily. And so I was having telephone conversations with folks, you know, friends of mine, and we always are conspiring as to how we can make the world a better place for the people we know, like, and love. And then somebody, again, quite by accident, I was in a conversation. I said, maybe you ought to do a podcast. And I said, yeah, it would be, I could be the author of getting the ball rolling. And so I thought, you know, to me, the biggest metaphor for passing enlightenment, which I don't mean as being smarter. I mean it as like being able to see things, you know, mm-hmm. like the, you know, enlightenment is the opposite of enheavenment. See, I don't have a problem with making stuff up. But the point is that I wanted to give people an opportunity to the friends that I have to express in a powerful way what they were feeling about how do you access empowerment in a world right now where it just seems to be at a real minimum of availability. And that's where we started the podcast. It's,
yeah, I think empowerment is a very key term, and it's something that's been used a lot now because so many things that happen to us, especially when you look at loss, loss can be extremely disempowering in the early phases because of what it does to us physically, mentally, cognitively, emotionally. But we have to learn that we and buy into the fact that we can empower ourselves to still craft the life of our dreams in spite of the challenges that life presents us. And I think empowerment and helping individuals see that they can empower themselves is a great mission for your podcast. And I think any podcast that really floats that theme around.
Yeah, it's a notion that has morphed and, you know, it's got different people involved with it now. I've got a partner for over the last year who, you know, we've had guests on and that sort of thing. But Jan Jeremias, who I lovingly refer to as my twin, I'm 6'4". Right around 250 pounds, and I think she's about 5'2". Dripping wet, she's probably about 85 pounds. And we don't share the same philosophies about many things. However, we love each other, and we have the best conversations, and we're always rooting for each other to be great. And that's a lot of fun.
Well, and that's a great model, too, for just being able to constructively and lovingly hold space for individuals that have differences in philosophies. Just because we have differences in philosophies doesn't mean we can't learn from it, doesn't mean that we can't coexist with each other, and doesn't mean that we can't work together. So it sounds like that you and Jan are a good example in the podcasting world of differing philosophies coming together to put together a pretty dynamic product.
Well, I could say we're an odd couple, but it's more fun to say we're twins.
Yeah, I think so. Like in the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Twins with Danny DeVito. Absolutely.
Along those lines.
One of my last questions for you, my friend, is if you're going to leave our listeners with one takeaway today, what would that be?
Life's hard. Just know that. And in any moment, you have a choice. Do something or don't. I want to just offer you, choose doing the hard thing. Choose doing the thing that moves you closer to your dream and do it until it works. Don't just try. Don't do it a few times and stop. Be smart enough to surround yourself with people who will be your crazy cheering squad. That no matter how weird it sounds, if what you want to accomplish is really good for you and good for the world, use their energy, use it shamelessly. And when you're down, give yourself permission to forgive yourself for having done that immediately, if not sooner, because life is not about how many times you don't succeed. It's about how long it takes for you to make a decision after you've just failed. As Churchill said, before you move on to the next failure with enthusiasm. Mm.
Absolutely. And anytime we fail, it's information on what we can do in the future to be better and to get a better outcome.
Yep. All about getting that better question.
You got it. And finally, Bill, if people want to contact you, find out more about your services, purchase Faces of Grief, what's the best way for them to do that?
I'll make it simple for these folks. They know how to get in touch with you. And if they will send you an email, if you don't mind, Dave, you just refer it to me. I'll be happy to engage with anybody that you send to me. Is that fair?
That's fair to me. And I'll put both the email for the podcast and my personal email down so that they are empowered to choose.
They're going to see you more frequently than they'll think about seeing me. But if there's anybody out there that sees this and you're moved to contact me, I invite you to do so. I love that. And I love sharing thoughts with folks. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Bill. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.